This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Four crows perched on the telephone wires in front of my house. They were all watching me in a curious manner. I took it as a sign that they knew that John Maslov is returning to Locus Focus this morning for another animated discussion about these extremely smart birds whose highly developed social skills mirror those of humans. This morning, we'll learn about our uniquely symbiotic relationship with crows as we find out what goes on in a crow's brain that makes them such fascinating creatures. John Maslov is a professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington School of Environmental and Forest Sciences, and the author of Gifts of the Crow, now out in paperback, which takes us on a tour of the corvid brain from perspectives of biology, chemistry, and whimsy. John, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara. Great to be here.
And it's good to have you back. I understand you've been doing a bit of traveling around Portland, talking about crows and getting interviewed by the Oregonian and a number of other things.
Well, I did spend some time in Portland. Yeah, it was great with Audubon, and also there was a nice conference down there from wildlife rehabbers. So it was great to talk with them and get some of their insights as well about the corvids that they take care of.
Well, I'm not sure how much of it has to do with your book or if it's just something cosmic happening, but it seems like there's a great deal of interest in crows. It's ever-growing, as is the crow population in Portland. So maybe they have something to do with each other.
Yeah, I think, and, you know, again, this is a bird that people interact with in so many ways. It's a very familiar animal, so that just brings up these sorts of interactions and realizations that they're there and that they're influencing us.
Well, I was thinking as I was greeted by the crows the other day when I was coming home, how we often think of crows as harbingers and not always of good things. And I was thinking that if I hadn't read your book, those crows that were waiting for me would have made me nervous. But instead, I was very intrigued by them and tried to figure out what they were trying to tell me. Why is it that we find crows threatening and fascinating at the same time?
Well, I think the threatening part is just a long-standing culture that we've had as humans with these animals. They've been around places that are associated with death because they're scavengers. They've been around our dumps and other places like that as well. So they kind of conjure up the areas that we really don't like to spend a lot of time in. And so that is deep, deep in our psyche. I think literally in our brain. And when we hear them or see them or experience them in a variety of ways, that's the first thing that pops up in a lot of people's heads, because that's the history of our cultural interaction with them.
But
I think they're also fascinating. You know, more recently, I think people are, you know, if you're interested in nature, there's a lot of nature that's kind of invisible, and you can't really interact much with it. But with crows, they're right there. They're in your yard. They're in your parks. They're around your cars when you stop or come back and forth from traveling, and they're stimulating in that way just because they are so visible.
Well, do you think that they really are harbingers?
No, I don't think they're harbingers. I think they're associated with some things that we consider unpleasant, like death in particular. So oftentimes when you see them, they may be associated with that. But I think, you know, what really goes on is that because of this long-standing cultural connection that we've had with these birds and the stories and other ways they've seeped into our psyche, when something bad does happen to us, or when we expect something perhaps bad, we might focus on the crow or the raven that's around, maybe even more so than if something like that hasn't happened or isn't expected. And so they might actually seem to us to be harbingers. We have an awful lot of stories from people who've had unique experiences with these birds preceding or just after the death of a loved one, for example. I mean, it's a recurring theme when people talk to me about these birds. And I think a lot of it is because we're just more tuned into them when we're under those stressful sorts of times in our lives. And that, I think, is a hearkening back to this long-standing culture that they've had with us.
Well, actually, I think birds in general are associated with harbingers and also associated with maybe coming to terms with death. A number of years ago, a close friend of ours died in a car crash, and one of our very close friends, who was friends of her, who lives way out in the countryside in this little cabin off in the woods, and the day that after our friend was killed, she had a bird that came into our house, and mm-hmm. she spent a lot of time, you know, actually relating to the bird and then getting the bird safely out of the house. And I had some, well, different experience, but relative, when after my mother died and I came back from the East Coast, and for a week there were these three juvenile bald eagles that would circle over our house every day.
Yeah.
It turned out that they became very common because there's a lot of bald eagles that are being raised in our neighborhood now. But these are associations we both made, and we talked particularly with our friend who was very tuned into nature, and it didn't take the death of a close friend to make her that tuned in, that maybe birds have a special relationship with us, that they, I don't know. I mean, it just seemed that in ancient cultures, there's always this association with birds coming at certain pivotal times in our lives.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And because of that importance throughout our history, when we need comforting or when we're especially reflective or whatever the situation may demand of us, birds are there. We tend to focus on them. We relate to them. We perhaps spend more time with them or consider them more deeply under those sorts of situations than just normally.
Well, I don't know if you're a fan of the Stephen Colbert Show, but
yeah.
A few weeks ago, he ran a little number which made me think of you, and also that I realized that he's not quite up on things. But he was showing video of a crow using tools. And
yeah.
I think it's a crow that you actually talk about in the beginning of your book. And he was very upset about the fact that crows might be smarter than people. So he's going to show just how much smarter he is than the crow trying to get this food out of this box. And he takes a sledgehammer to it.
Right.
Did you see that sequence by any chance?
I did. A lot of people sent it to me, of course, after the fact. And it was a New Caledonia crow that he was challenging there, for sure.
What did you think of that? I just wonder, as far as taking it seriously, that crows, in fact, have these very specialized and rather extraordinary skills.
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, the New Caledonia crow that he was pitting his savvy against is the ultimate tool user, probably a better tool-using animal, certainly than any bird, and certainly as good, if not better, than most mammals, including the primates. This bird can, you know, craft tools, it constructs them, it passes down the culture of these tools within its different family groups and social groups, and it's very sophisticated in making these tools and using them under a variety of situations. So that the New Caledonia crow would beat most people, very young people, I should say, you know, 2 to 3, 4-year-old kids, it'll beat them at getting food out of a difficult-to-reach place because it'll bend a piece of wire and use it as a hook to get that out or spear it if that's allowed in that situation. And most kids won't. They'll do exactly what Colbert did, and that is they'll just destroy the container and get the food out, and they will certainly get more at the end, the human will, but they'll do it in a very unsophisticated way. And an adult crow, a New Caledonia crow, is going to beat us on that task most of the times.
How long before you think they might be able to get the handle of using power tools?
Yeah, I think that'll be a while. I don't think they'll be using power tools anytime in the near future.
Well, another thing that it's interesting to me about crows is their sound. And I know people that are driven crazy by crows. In fact, this woman who lives in the Ladd Circle neighborhood in Portland, which is a heavily treed neighborhood, and I think one of the first neighborhoods that had a big inundation of crows 25 years ago or so, she talked about a neighbor of hers who is resorted to sleeping in the basement because he couldn't stand the sound of all the crows, which I thought was a rather extreme reaction. But I've had the experience of being down in Oaks Bottom, the wildlife refuge near my house, and, you know, wanting to listen to songbirds, and all I can hear are the crows. But actually, you write about the fact that crows are considered a songbird. So what is it about the way the crows vocalize compared to the way that a warbler or a song sparrow vocalizes?
Well, technically, they are songbirds. The corvids, including crow and raven, are the largest songbirds. And that's a technical designation based upon their throat musculature and how the muscles of the throat wrap around the syrinx, which is the voice box of the bird, and allows them to make such a diversity of sounds. Now, as far as the pleasantry of sounds from crows or ravens versus some other songbirds, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with the basic pitch and the modulation of that pitch. And certainly, warblers and thrush and birds like that are able to make really things that are much more like music to us and therefore, I think, more auditorially appealing to most people. But the variety of noises and the mimicking abilities of crows and ravens is really amazing and turns an awful lot of people on as well, just because of the sheer unbelievable nature of some of the noises they can make, barking dogs or cows or whatever, human voice as far as that goes. But I think the most common vocalizations that they make are calls, not songs, and they're calls that communicate very important elements in their social life to one another. And those are kind of mundane chatterings, and they're low frequency, and they're kind of caustic to most people's ears. But, you know, if you listen carefully, I think you can also hear some beauty in those calls as well.
Well, also, I found as I started appreciating the diversity of sounds that crows made that they make some really trippy sounds.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about some of the other less associated sounds with crows that, in fact, because I live around so many crows, I'm beginning to realize that a lot of these other sounds are almost as common as the caws.
Right. So they rattle. Female corvids rattle often and in a variety of paces and frequency, you know, double knocks or triple or just a long buzz out there that gets people, intrigued, and they wouldn't think that sound came from a crow, but that's quite common. Some of them sound like they're meowing or saying hello. That's a pretty frequent call that's given this time of year as they're starting to build nests and the male and female of a pair are associating closely, preening each other. You'll often hear that, and people will ask, you know, was this bird talking to me? But really it was talking to its mate. Lots of stranger, more subtle calls like that that unless you're really quite close to them or things are quite quiet around you, they're hard to hear.
Well, we're talking this morning about crows, if you're just tuning in. My guest is John Marsloff, who's the author of Gifts of the Crow. And John's been around Portland a few times. Actually, you were at Powell's Books not that long ago,
right,
doing a reading, and recently was at the Audubon Society. And there was an interesting article in the Argonian, I guess just about a week and a half ago, that was talking about the prevalence of crows in Portland, I mean, and kind of the niche that they fit into and people's responses to them. And John is extensively quoted as well as Bob Salinger from the Portland Audubon Society. And I wanted to talk about some of those social gatherings that the article was so taken with. And we're used to seeing crows gathering on trees and gathering on telephone wires or whatever, but I thought the article kind of got at a certain point about how crows actually have this very complex social life and a whole bunch of social networks, and how is that manifest?
Yeah, they do, and to be honest, we don't fully understand it. We don't even understand the smallest component of it, I don't think, very well. At its core is the pair bond, and that's a lifelong monogamous pair bond formed between the male and female breeding unit of crows. Sometimes their young will hang out in their territory for years and help them if there aren't other breeding opportunities available to those young. They're usually young males. So it's not uncommon to have a family group. Here in the West, it's usually just the pair and maybe one or maybe two of these helpers, we call them. In the East, it can be quite large, and my colleagues there, Kevin McGowan and others, have documented families of, you know, seven or nine birds from several generations that remain together on a territory and defend that space and cooperate to rear and guide young that are produced there each year. But that's pretty atypical out here in the West. It's much more the pair and one or two helpers at the most. And
why is that?
Are just by themselves. It probably has to do with the resource availability, the food availability, I would say, or space availability. And here in the West, where suburbanization is just increasing still dramatically, there's lots of new habitat created daily for crows to occupy. And so it's really as abundant as they are, there's still room for more, especially breeding territories. And the birds are still in the process of filling those territories. And therefore, the young have options that are better than staying at home. Their options are to go breed on their own on a new territory. That's the first option of any crow. And if that's not possible, or if a particular young isn't dominant enough to obtain a breeding space, then they'll stay at home. And that seems more likely in the East, where the birds have been at high densities for a long time.
So beyond that, those smaller structures, I mean, we see massive amounts of crows gathering in trees and gathering on hillsides. And what does that represent? Do they have tribes? Or
Yeah, that's what we just really don't know. They do gather in these large numbers. I think they're certainly neighborhoods. We know they recognize their adjacent territory owners, and they don't fight with them after, you know, relationships are established and that sort of thing, like a lot of birds do. So there's probably some larger spatial structure that the birds that live and forage in a particular area, you know, maybe it's a downtown park or maybe it's a suburb. Those birds probably all know each other and probably coordinate their activities more than they do with others from far away. So some of those gatherings may be the local groups like that. Let's say on the neighborhood of 50 to 100 birds, I would say, would easily be able to imagine those having a very personal relationship with one another and going to areas within that place where they live where food is super abundant on a given day. You know, maybe it's a dumpster full of food or a car, or maybe there's a roadkill or something like that. They'll gather at those places, and we'll see that. And they'll also gather where an individual is killed, and they'll learn from that situation. So we see those big gatherings that are probably among birds that are familiar with one another. But then beyond that, the huge super gatherings of, you know, tens of thousands of birds at a roost site at night, for example, how many of those know each other? How structured is that gathering? Nobody knows. We know that it happens. We know there are benefits to each individual being there. But how familiar they are with all those animals in that group, I don't know. I mean, it'd be like us saying, you know, we're familiar with everybody at a football game that we go to, which certainly we're not.
Well, you mentioned that the increase of suburbanization is actually opening up more crow habitat. And I find that curious because when I first moved to Portland 40 years ago, mm-hmm. crows were basically a rural bird, and you didn't see any crows in the city. And I moved out to the country a couple of years later. There were lots of crows around where I was living. And I didn't start noticing crows in Portland until maybe like 25 years ago, where they started to become a dominant city bird. In fact, seems to have taken over the role and the position of pigeons and starlings to some degree. So I'm wondering, what is it about city habitat that has drawn the crows here? And then the other part of the question is, why are suburban areas so appealing to crows?
So I think there's two things going on here. First off, for the Pacific Northwest in particular, crows were relatively rare throughout the area 40 years ago, 50 years ago. And they were confined primarily to the coasts and some of the open agricultural areas, as you said. They've increased in abundance here, much like the barred owl has, coming from the Midwest and over through southern Canada from the east. And their numbers have increased, and in fact, the subspecies that's here has also changed through time. And that's led to a great increase in the number of birds here. And that's, you know, concomitant with this change in the land cover, because if you think about, you know, what this area looked like 50 to 100 years ago, primarily it was forested. And a large forest, unbroken forest, is not crow habitat at all. They are a bird of scattered woodlands, agricultural, coastal areas, openings with places where they can also nest. So suburbanization has created that place here where it used to be large, unbroken tracts of forest. Now it's finely dissected patches of woods with lawns and other kinds of resources that we've made available, not only natural that would occur in the, you know, the opened forest lands, but also supplements in terms of our garbage and roadkill and things like that the birds use. So we've juxtaposed nesting sites in the small woods with great feeding opportunities in the lawns and parks and roadways that we have. And we've done that all in an area that was totally off limits to the crow before, and that is the deep forest. And now we've just made this mecca, really, is what I think of it as, for crows out here.
Well, I had wondered if some of the crows got driven into Portland 25 years ago because a lot of the farmland around Portland, that was about the time that it started getting turned into housing tracts. And so there was, in fact, in some ways, there's less open space in some of the suburbs around Portland than there is in Portland itself, where there's been an effort to revitalize natural areas.
Yeah, I don't know. I think they would have been very happy with the housing tracts that have been created out there, as they are elsewhere. During the actual process of conversion, yeah, it could be an impetus to move in, because that's a dangerous time. It's unpredictable. There's not a lot of resources. But we've been following suburbs being built out here over the last 12 or 15 years, and crow numbers build up pretty quickly in those new subdivisions within the first year or two. So there may have been some of that where there was a population that was displaced, but I think it has to do with increasing the number of birds, and a lot of the birds in general will go into the city even if they don't breed. A lot of our younger birds may actually flock and live in the city in a non-breeding situation because of the abundant resources. So there's green space for sure, and there's a lot of breeders there for sure, but there's also a lot of crows around that are just taking advantage of the food that's there. So that's a key driver of why they're in the city as well.
So they like to hang out at coffee houses and all the other hot spots.
And food trucks. I think the whole food truck movement is a key. It's a big thing for crows. They love it.
So maybe because Portland is a leader in street food, we are also becoming a leader in street crows.
There you go.
Now, I'm wondering, does this plethora of crows that we have in Portland, and I'm assuming also in the Seattle area, is that driving out other birds, or are they all finding some way to coexist? Is there enough room for them all?
That's a great question. I get asked that question all the time. I think there's little if no evidence for that. Certainly, there are birds being driven out of the city. But they're being driven out for the same reason crows have come in, and that is they don't tolerate people, and they don't utilize that resource and the disturbance that occurs in the city nearly to the extent that crows do. So you think about things like towhees or some of the warblers that nest on the ground, Wilson's warbler, for example, or Pacific wrens. Those animals are driven out of the city because their habitat is removed when we densify an area. We don't leave ground cover in particular, shrub cover and native forbs that are rich in insects that these birds need. Those things are removed. It doesn't bother crows because they're not feeding there. They're feeding in the more open areas. And if you look at a couple of the other really good urban birds, things like juncos and starlings and pigeons and sparrows, and what's the other species I'm thinking of? There's another good one. I'll think of it in a second. But anyway,
like chickadees.
Those birds, robins, they are doing pretty darn well in our urban areas, along with crows, because they all utilize the same sort of environment and the same resources that we provide.
Now, this is just kind of anecdotal, and I wonder if there's any reality to it, but it seems to me that as I've noticed an increase in crows, at least in my neighborhood, there's been a decrease in starlings and also a decrease in pigeons. I just wonder if there's some tension there between those three species.
There may be some over food, but not much. I think what you may be seeing more likely is direct action against pigeons, which happens in a lot of cities, to remove them from the city. They're trapped out and shot out and removed because we don't tolerate them. And the other thing with starlings need cracks and holes in buildings. And as we tighten things up and redesign our urban spaces, we tend to get rid of a lot of those sorts of crevices that the starling absolutely requires for nesting, and their numbers decline. But I would bet if you look hard, you'll see there's been some bird removal activity in Portland that targets starlings and pigeons as well.
Well, actually, we used to have cracks in our attic, and we had starlings living in there for a number of years, and we fixed that, and we don't have the starlings anymore.
There you go.
I saw a flock of starlings the other day down in Oaks Bottom, and I was actually surprised because it was the first flock of starlings I'd seen there in a while. So
yep.
I know they haven't gone away, but it seems like there's a lot wider range of birds in Portland across the board, whether it's in the wildlife refuge, in the natural areas, or even just in the neighborhoods. And one of the birds that we've been seeing a lot more in the last 10, especially 20 years, are raptors. And there's a lot of them in my neighborhood because of the wildlife refuge, though I have friends who've lost chickens in areas of Portland far away from any natural areas, so that the hawks have definitely found a niche in Portland as well.
Yeah, and I think that's the second part I didn't get to with the response of crows to the city, is that crows and a lot of other birds, like Cooper's hawks in particular for raptors and redtails, they've really become adept at using the city, and there's lots of resources there, rats and other birds around feeders and things that Cooper's hawks, for example, are using, and squirrels. And those species are basically taming down. They're becoming very much urban dwellers because of the safety and resources that are provided there, and their numbers have gone way up in urban areas for sure.
And just like people, I sometimes wonder if the traits of urban birds are similar in a way to traits of urban people as opposed to rural birds or wilderness birds.
Yeah, they are. Actually, there is some similarity there. One, the birds that do well in urban areas are typically a bit larger than the typical bird. They are often social and flocking. Wouldn't be so for raptors, but it is for a lot of the other species. So they use social information, which we, of course, thrive upon. And they're flexible. They're more generalists than they are real specialists on a particular resource, which, again, is kind of our hallmark. I mean, I think the ability to learn from your mistakes and others' mistakes and to try things and find things that you wouldn't maybe expect would be good, that's a real hallmark of our success, as well as a lot of these birds that live with us.
Well, we're talking this morning with John Marsliff, who's the author of Gifts of the Crow, and we're learning all the ways in which crows are very much like us. And I guess there's ways in which they're different, but they seem to be more physical than actually in the way that they behave. You mentioned that crows learn from, that we learn from our mistakes. I was wanting to talk a bit about the way that you've seen crows learn from their mistakes as well.
Yeah, crows make associations extremely rapidly. One of the things we looked at in that respect was their trust of people, for example. And those that are harassed by us, whether it's, you know, experimenters like us that catch them or people that chase them away, those individuals are remembered for a long time, longer than we've been following them at this point. And they are held in contempt, basically, by the crows and viewed as a new predator. So they learn these new dangers in their area very quickly. They probably also learn from the sight of a dead animal. We've done some preliminary tests on that and seen that spatial memory centers in their brain are activated when they're looking at a person holding a dead crow, for example, which would suggest they're learning either about that new person as being dangerous associated with the dead animal or the area around it that could be a place to avoid. And that kind of matches what a lot of people have told us, that, you know, when you harass crows in one area, they'll avoid that area in their flight patterns or their daily activities. So they're taking in all these signals in their environment about danger and using those to adjust their daily life.
Well, in your book, you describe some specific relationships between crows and people. And I'm remembering there's a woman who the crow liked a lot and he didn't like her husband.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could tell that story.
Yeah, that's my favorite story by far. It was actually a magpie. It wasn't a crow, but they're in the same family. And if they ever make it across the Cascades, we'll be able to enjoy them more here on the west side of the mountains. But this was in Sweden, and the woman was feeding magpies in her backyard one winter, just giving her little bits of fat and scraps from the kitchen to the birds. And the birds took to that, of course, and ate the food. And the woman would be in her house, and she thought that was cool, and occasionally she'd see the birds kind of peering in the windows or paying attention as she would walk by the windows, and she thought that was really neat. So she continued to feed them, and then they started to knock on the windows and seemed to be trying to get her attention, and that was really cool, so she fed them. And then the doorbell started to ring, and she'd go to answer the doorbell, and there was nobody there. And then finally she found the magpies ringing the doorbell. They were actually pressing down. It was a lion's tongue that they had to push down to ring the bell, very fancy old Scandinavian bell. They'd ring it, and she'd come out, and that was, you know, to her, that was the ultimate. So she would feed them even more, and, of course, they continue to do this. She really shaped their behavior to get her attention for food. And then I talked to her husband as well, and he was not keen on this at all, kind of the more standard culture of looking at these birds as either thieves or bad omens. So he acted like he threw something at them one day. And from that day on, they basically whitewashed his car window every morning, so thick with bird crap that they had to clean it off before he could even drive to work. And he tried moving his car and, you know, switching places with the woman, and it just didn't work. They had him pegged, and they knew his car, and they made sure he knew of his mistake every day.
And was there any way to resolve this problem he was having with the magpies?
No, they eventually moved, which I thought was probably a good thing, except then the woman informed me that she has started to feed seagulls in her area now. So I don't see this problem really getting any better for the man.
I think she needs to watch out for Hitchcock's movie, The Birds, maybe.
Yep.
Well, I also, speaking of cars and the magpies' response acting out on cars, you also have a story about, I guess it was either ravens or crows, the juvenile delinquents up in the Northern Cascades National Park.
Yeah, there was a it was happening just a few years ago up in the North Cascades that a raven who was quickly named Hitchcock by the local park managers was ripping off the windshield wipers, just the rubber part, from people's cars. And we don't have any idea why he was doing this or anything. He would apparently just rip them off and drop them on the ground. We went up to check it out, my daughter and I, and there were just windshield wipers in these parking areas where people would frequently leave their car to go hiking or in some of the visitor areas as well. So that was a potential danger, of course, for hazard for people that would not have windshield wipers in some of the rainstorms there. So rather than just remove this bird, which was kind of, you know, one of the ideas, we just kill it and get it out of the way, the Park Service, of course, didn't want to do that and instead asked us to have a look and see if there was some other way we could stop this behavior or understand it. So we just captured the bird and its mate. Typically, we do that for studying a bird, to tag it so we can follow it. And we catch it with a net that's fired by a gun that makes a big, loud noise and captures the bird or pins it to the ground. And we went running up to the bird in this case. We actually caught he and his mate together in the place where they were doing a lot of this bad behavior. And instead of being very calm and collective when we banded them, we made a bit of a show about it and tried to impress upon the bird, literally, that this was a bad place for him to be. So as we held him, we actually banded him and did all of our measurements and tagging and things on top of a car's windshield so that it was looking at the wiper of the windshield on the car as it was having this bad experience of being held by a human and, you know, humiliated by having its wing measured or its mass weighed. And during this time, we hoped that it would be forming one of these really fearful memories. Maybe neurons in the hippocampus would be strengthening their connection with those in its amygdala that imply the fear of being in this situation. And the visual processing areas in the forebrain would connect with those spatial memories and emotional feelings so that the next time that bird saw a windshield wiper or saw this place, it would have a strong aversion to coming back there. And we did that. We let Hitchcock and his mate go and then watch to see what would happen. And certainly his activity in that area was much more reserved, very cautious around the place, the visitor center, and also didn't interact with car windshields nearly to the extent that it had before. And at the same time, the park had given people pieces of PVC pipe to put over their windshield wipers to reduce Hitchcock's availability to get at these wipers. So we had two things going for us. One, he had less access, and he had a bad experience, as did his mate. And that really turned him off. Over the next year, the windshield wiper stealing basically dropped off, and that bird and his mate still lives up in the North Cascades now and lives kind of in harmony with people there, at least, not doing the things that were really intolerable to the Park Service. And it just shows, I think, a kind of a general lesson that these smart animals, especially long-lived ones like a raven or even a wolf, we're better off trying to train them to live with us than to simply remove them and hope that the next one that comes in will be a, you know, a better citizen.
Well, your book is titled Gifts of the Crow, and that actually refers specifically to physical gifts that crows give to people that are special to them. But I also wonder if there is a general sense of the ways that crows gift us as a from one species to another.
Yeah, I think it's a great metaphor for an awful lot of the interaction we have with wild animals and those that we know so well, like, you know, the crow that lives in your backyard. They give us really insights into another world and how animals behave and, you know, what is and isn't possible, what's likely, how we go about interacting with that nature and how it reflects our actions back upon us.
Well, it's been really fine talking with you again, John. And I wonder, are you planning, are you continuing your work with crows or are you spreading out to other species now?
Well, no, I'm still doing work with crows. We're looking more at their neural responses to situations, and we're investigating more the funeral ideas that they conduct funerals around dead birds to try to understand that a bit more. I branch out to other things. I have students all over the place that are studying different birds, and we do have some new work going on with trying to understand if there's a way to keep wolves in our landscapes here along with people. And so we're trying to understand a variety of the ways we interact with nature.
So are there lessons that you've learned from working with crows that might apply to wolves that you already are seeing?
Yes, I think so. I mean, they are similar species in that some people love them and some people hate them. And there are long, deep-seated feelings about the species, especially the intolerance of them. And I think, again, looking at how do you get people to engage with a often reviled but very smart and social and savvy animal like the crow or the wolf, there's a lot of similarities there. It's the big difference, of course, is that crows really can't hurt you, and wolves can certainly impact our activities much more so than crows can. So there are some real differences there, but there are some very similar lessons, and I hope you know, good lessons that we can take from our understanding of crows and apply to the other species that we try to live with as well, like wolves.
Well, another big difference I see between crows and wolves is that wolves actually don't like to live in company of human beings and are much more of a remote species. And crows, for some reason, really seem to thrive around us.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are some species that do very well with us. Crows are right on the, you know, the hallmark of being able to do that. It's why they've been so successful, for sure.
So one last thing. What is it, do you think, that makes crows, that draws crows to us in the same way that we're drawn to crows?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with our lifestyle. And as humans, we produce a lot of waste, whether it's, you know, extra food that we don't use or supplements that we leave around in garbage dumps and things like that. And our ability to produce more than we use just provides this opportunity for another species that, if they use that same resource, which crows do, they eat the same things we do, they can do very, very well with us.
So an excuse to produce more garbage because it helps the crows.
There you go.
I actually wonder, though, if there's a way that crows can maybe help us to be more conscious about how much garbage we produce.
I think they're the ultimate, you know, bioassay or barometer, environmental barometer of our actions, because most of what we do that is wasteful and overconsumptive is reflected in the number of crows that are around, for sure.
So we like to keep them to a nice level, but not overwhelming. And
there you go.
So it's kind of like a garbage meter for us.
It absolutely is. It's a living garbage meter.
Well, it's been really fun talking with you, John. I hope we can do this again. Maybe on your next project we'll reconnect.
My pleasure as well, Barbara. Thank you.
It's unusual for me actually to be able to pull two interviews out of the same book, but I've really enjoyed this book. So and I understand the last time we had you on, a lot of people downloaded the interview. So I guess a lot of people are fascinated by crows.
Great. I'm glad they are, and hope we can keep them interested.
Okay. Well, we've been talking with John Marsloff, who's author of Gifts of the Crow, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website and go to kboo.fm and in the search bar put in Locus Focus and today's date, and the show will come up. Next week, my guest is Gloria Flora. We'll be talking about fighting gas and oil development in Montana's Rocky Mountain Front. And this is also the first of a couple Pledge Drive specials, because our Pledge Drive, I believe, starts this Thursday. So get your pocket, your checkbooks out or whatever, your fingers ready to punch that donate button. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Kathleen Stevenson today. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening.
There's a crow flying, talking ragged tree to tree. He's black as the highway that's leading me. Now he's diving down to pick up on something shiny. I feel like that black crow flying in a blue sky. To the highway, then I drove to a pontoon plane. I took a plane to a taxi, and a taxi to a train. I've been traveling so long. How am I ever gonna know my home when I see it again? I'm like a black
in conjunction with March Music Moderne, A Different Nature presents a live broadcast from Merrillhurst University, A Soldier's Tale. Igor Stravinsky's iconic masterpiece, plus recent music it has inspired, including three movements from Wynton Marsalis, A Fiddler's Tale. Tune in to A Different Nature Monday, March 18th, for a special three-hour installment beginning at 7 p.m., KBOO is a proud media sponsor of March Music Moderne 2013. Full info on this and all events at marchmusicmoderne.org.
You are about to cross the border.
KBOO Community Radio turns 45 this year, and our first 2013 membership drive starts on the 21st. Help make reaching our $99,000 fundraising goal a little easier by offering a matching donation of at least $500 for us to use on air during the drive. Matches are really great motivators to entice our non-contributing listeners to donate, so please email membership@kboo.org if you would like to offer a match or have any questions. Or call 503-231-8032 and ask for the membership department to plan your spring drive matching gift today.
Fifty years ago, carrying only a tape recorder and a microphone, Chris Strachowicz started a journey that would bring regional roots music to the rest of America and to the world. Join me, Phil G., and my co-host, Alicia Olson, on Saturday, March 30th, as we bring you a five-hour special celebrating 53 years of Chris and his label, Arhuli Records, and the music that has been brought to us. From Tejano border music to Cajun and Zydeco styles, from Mississippi and Texas blues to San Francisco folk and jug bands, Arhuli recorded it and brought it to the world. Tune in Saturday, March 30th, from 2 to 7 p.m. as we celebrate the music of Arhuli Records here on listener-powered 90.7 KBOO.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning. You're listening to Health Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Anne Fletcher, is a renowned health and medical writer and the author of seven books, including Sober for Good, Thin for Life, and Eating Thin for Life. Fletcher is the former executive editor of the Tufts University Health and Nutrition Letter and a contributing editor for Prevention Magazine. She's here on Health Watch today to talk about her latest book, Inside Rehab: The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. If you want to join the conversation today on Health Watch, the number is 503-231-8187. Welcome to Health Watch, Ann Fletcher.
Hello, good to be with you.
Well, why don't we start out by orienting our listeners to how this became an investigation for you and why?
Well, I had previously written, as you mentioned, a book called Sober for Good, which was about the many routes to alcohol recovery amongst people who had long-term sobriety. Nobody had ever written a book about people who got sober and stayed sober. And these people, had more than 200 people who had been sober for at least 5 years, were interviewed, surveyed, answered a lot of questions about how they maintain their sobriety. In the course of writing that book, I got to know one of the leading experts who studied addiction treatment programs, Dr. Thomas McClellan, who founded the Addiction Treatment Research Institute in Philadelphia, which is affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania. So he studied addiction, and still does, studied addiction treatment programs across the country in research studies. And I got to know him in writing Sober for Good, and he kept telling me what he was finding about the state of addiction treatment in this country. And it was really disturbing. And I stayed in touch with him over the course of the past 10 years, and he was telling me things like addiction treatment programs have unqualified professionals. Most of them don't have adequate medical treatment. They don't have psychologists and social workers on staff. Their staff turnover is as high as it is in fast food restaurants. Well, that's not good for patients when staff are coming and going all the time. They're not using science-based treatments. So I really became intrigued with this. And about 5 years ago, when Brittany and Lindsay began hopping in and out of rehab, I got really intrigued and decided to write a book about it. And I thought, you know, the public isn't informed about addiction treatment. Somebody needs to go inside. And I decided to do that. I visited 15 addiction treatment programs all across the country and interviewed more than 100 people who had recently been in addiction treatment. And that became Inside Rehab.
So when you say addiction treatment, you're talking both inpatient and outpatient treatment?
That's correct, and I just use rehab to describe it all, although we usually think of rehab as residential treatment, where you go away overnight. Typically think of it as 30 days, although most people need a lot more than that, and we can talk about why that is. But residential treatment, which we usually see people going to on TV, really represents very little of the kind of addiction treatment that goes on in this country. 80 to 90% of it is outpatient, where people are going usually by day or often in the evening for just a couple of hours, a couple of times a week, or sometimes it's more intense than that, but they go home and live at their homes. That's what most of addiction treatment is in this country. And actually, the research studies find it to be, in general, just as effective